In this week's episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I are going to be talking about how to choose conferences and other live events, .NET versus open source, ideas for low-risk businesses, and answering more listener questions. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 113. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
We're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this, Mike?
Well, I found out a short time ago that our good friend and popular MicroConf speaker, Patrick McKenzie, has a ebook that he published called Sell More Software, Website Conversion Optimization for Software Developers.
Indeed, yeah. I bought it off of HyperInc.com the other day. I'm digging HyperInc. They turn a lot of blogs into books.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see my tweet about it?
But I definitely did see it on Amazon's website.
Oh, it's on Amazon.
Yep. That's probably where I saw it. I don't know exactly how I ended up there, though. It might have been recommended to me through their recommendation engine. I'm not real sure. But it's interesting. I mean, he's got most of the content, I think, is primarily taken from his blog, but there's also some new articles that he's written in there exclusively for the book about selling software and conversion optimization and SEO. So I think for $10, you probably can't go wrong.
I've read most of the essays in the book as they were published in the blog, but since I bought the book last week, I've only read a couple of them already. It's like, yeah, no doubt. I'm going to take enough ideas away from this that it'll be worth the 10 bucks. Funny thing about HyperInc, did you know they're YC funded?
No, I didn't.
Which is weird because it's such a non-scalable business, in my opinion. But they basically have done like two or three pivots from where they originally were. They're kind of just an online publisher, and they've seemed to have some success doing this niche of turning blogs into books. And they format them well, and I think they do some copy editing and stuff. There's a number of blogs, like startup and VC blogs, that have been turned into books, and they're all between maybe $3 and $10, and they're all electronic. So it's a no-brainer if you need something to read. I mean, you can typically find a lot of the content for free, but it's like, why not pay the money to have it in the easy to read format.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of my essays actually made it into one of them. Dharmesh has his On Startups HyperInc book. I wrote a blog post for that a while ago, and it made it into the book. So
very cool. Or what have you been doing this past week?
Yeah, I've basically had 2 weeks of kind of on again, off again downtime. I like to take these times to do that high level thinking that I don't get done much when I'm sitting in front of a computer. You find that when you're in front of a computer, you always want to be niggling away at like email or Twitter, or just, you know, kind of your monkey brain runs wild and it doesn't let you sit there and like brainstorm and think about high level things that you want to do over the next coming months or the coming year or whatever.
Yeah, I find that being in front of a computer sometimes is distracting if I don't have something specifically that I want to get done. You know, it's kind of a time sink at that point. I may as well be on Facebook or Hacker News or something like that because I'm not really being productive and I'm there to be there versus there to be productive.
Right. And that's where I find this time where I'm kind of forced to be away from the computer, you know, because I'm typically with family or friends and often we're, you know, eating, talking, watching movies and such. Or there's even downtime where everybody's reading and just chatting. I mean, that is like a good time to, I think, to relax and kind of center your mind and prepare it for the deep thinking that's required to think about high level things, about where the directions and the strategy that you're going to take your business. Because again, I think sitting in front of the computer is not the right time to do that.
Yeah, I think that just taking, you know, a couple of days even away from the computer, not touch the computer, not even check your email, those time periods can be highly productive, I'll say, for thinking about those other things.
So you're only 2 weeks away from launching AutoChark. How are things?
Things are pretty good. I don't have this nagging sense of something's wrong, but I'm not sure what it is. So I think I'm feeling pretty good about where things are at. There's tons of things that I would love to have implemented. There's tons of things that are sitting in fog bugs that are just not done, and they will not be done. And I'm okay with that.
Right. So the technical side seems to be zipped up. Are you feeling good about the marketing and kind of what your launch, about getting people to use it, early access users and such?
I feel like I'm going to get people to use it, whether it is exactly what they're looking for, whether there's going to be tweaks and stuff. I kind of expect that there's going to be some things that they're going to look at and say, hey, I'd really like it if it could do this or it could do that. And that's fine. I'm perfectly okay with that. But I really need to start getting it in front of people and getting feedback from a general market sense of what people are looking for and what they are really interested in seeing.
This week, though, we're going to be diving in and answering more listener questions. And our first question is about how to choose which meetups and conferences to attend. It's from Felix Leong, who's a longtime listener and Academy member. And he sent us a number of questions, but the one I really want to focus on today is he's wondering what criteria we could recommend for which meetups and conferences to go to. And he said, you know, do you use a selective approach, like checking out the speakers, whether the topic's within your interest, or do you just go to every single free meetup and kind of do a taste or a buffet approach and see which ones you like and stick with? So I think we kind of have two topics here, meetups versus conferences, because meetups are going to be more recurring, either weekly or monthly things, whereas conferences are probably going to be a larger expense where you have to travel.
I think with conferences, you definitely have to think about, are there going to be other people there who are in similar situations to me? And if you are not thinking that question or you don't have that question, you definitely need to ask it. And once you've asked it, the answer should be yes. And if the answer is not yes, then you have to reevaluate why it is that you're going. If you're going with just because you want to hang out with those types of people, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you're looking to increase your business or figure out what sorts of things other people are doing that you're not doing that you could be, then you know you might want to start thinking about going to a different type of conference. That said, for meetups, I think that with meetups tend to be, I think I tend to use the same type of criteria. There's a lot of meetups here in the Boston area that I just don't go to because I know that the types of people there tend to be the types of people who are focused on solving problems for which they will be using VC funding. And the approaches that they use are not the same approaches that I would use. And they are generally not applicable because they have tons of money to throw around on all these different things to try and figure out what's going to work. And I can't do that. And for me to even try to do those types of things, it's just not feasible because I don't have that money to throw around and my return on them just, it wouldn't be there. That's not to say that I wouldn't get something from them, but it's just that I feel like the value is disproportionate in terms of what I would get out of it versus what I would get out of going to someplace where there are a lot of other people like me.
Yeah, I definitely take different approaches for meetups versus conferences. Conferences, it's fairly easy to just ask people within your network. So I would probably go into the Micropreneur Academy as an example if I'd never heard of a conference, and I would go into the forums there and I'd say, who's been here? What do you guys think? Because since a conference tends to only happen once, maybe twice a year, and there aren't that many conferences in our space, you're going to have someone who has gone, and it's going to be, you know, a longer process where you're going to be able to really find out more details about it. And like you said, I think the big question that I ask myself is, are there going to be other people there in my situation? Because if you go to a conference and it's a bunch of people, you know, even if it's a startup conference, if it's a bunch of people who are freelancers, client services people, and they're thinking about launching startups and they're there to learn about it, well, if you're further along, then it's going to be a drag because the content's not going to fit and the people you meet, you just aren't going to have enough to talk about. You aren't going to take much away from it. The hallway conversations are not going to be interesting. So that's the first approach I take with conferences. And then in terms of meetups, whenever I move to a new place, I pretty much try to survey all the meetups in the area. Now, that wouldn't be possible if you moved to San Francisco, because I think there are several hundred startup meetups within a 60-mile radius. Most other places around the world, you're going to be able to check out all of the startup and even remotely tech entrepreneur meetups over the course of a couple of months. And since they are free or relatively not expensive, I tend to take that taster approach that Felix talked about and attend all of them just to start seeing overlap, seeing who's involved in the community. I think that's a great way to learn who is there in, you know, in your local area who's interested in startups, because in general, it tends to be a small tight-knit community, starting to meet the people who are in your niche. And like Mike said, you know, bootstrappers may be a niche depending on where you live. And so one by one, trying to find those people and potentially even putting together a meetup of just those bootstrappers would be something that I would consider. So I hope that helps, Felix. Our next question is a voicemail question about the pros and cons of .NET and open source.
Hey guys, it's Jack Coletti from Kula in Pittsburgh, and love the show, and finally got a chance to do a rating for you guys on iTunes. But my question is around .NET. I think it would be great for you guys. You have a pretty extensive .NET expertise. I'd love to hear maybe a whole show on the topic, or maybe .NET versus open source platforms. Would love to hear more in depth. Thanks again, and keep up the great work. Take care. Bye-bye.
So I think that there's a couple of different thoughts here. The first one is that when you start taking a look at the pros and cons of open source versus something like .NET, you know, there's going to be things for both of them. There's going to be pros for each. There's going to be cons for each. I think for .NET, the pros list for me is relatively short, just like it is on the open source side. I think on .NET, the pros are that it's very easy to start getting into the .NET stack. You can sign up for any of the Spark, I'll say the asterisk Spark programs from Microsoft. There's BizSpark, WebSpark. I think they've got YouthSpark now. And you can sign up for these programs and you get a lot of software for free. And after 3 years, you get to graduate from these programs and then you get to keep all the software that you've been using. In addition to that, you get to keep the production licenses for some of that stuff. So, for example, when you finish with BizSpark, I know that recently I went through the graduation process for Audit Shark, and they basically give you a Visual Studio Ultimate Edition for every developer you have working on there who's registered inside the program. And they gave me, I think, what was it, 4 Windows Server licenses and 2 SQL Server licenses to use for however long I want. And then in addition to that, they give you upgrade discounts for buying into their MSDN premium subscriptions. On the open source side, you know, pretty much everything is free from day one. You don't have to sign up for anything. You just, you know, go and you download it and you can compile it or not. For me, I think the biggest downside on the open source side isn't so much that everything's free. It's that you have to kind of pick and choose which community stacks that you're going to be using, because not all of them are going to be supported. And if you run into any problems, you will probably have to fix them yourself. Not always, but there are going to be times where you have to get down and dirty into the code, into some deep-rooted bug that you didn't want to, and you're going to spend a lot of time doing that stuff. On the Microsoft side, I feel like Microsoft tends to take care of things for you. That said, if there are problems that are deep-rooted, you may not get them fixed in a timely fashion, or you may not ever get them fixed. At the end of the day, it almost feels like a judgment call. It's to me, it doesn't necessarily make a lot of difference. When you start talking about cost, I think the one issue that a lot of people will bring up is that on the open source side, everything's cheaper. And on Microsoft, it costs a lot more to run those things. At the end of the day, though, your biggest cost of your business is employees and your salary. And those are going to be exponentially greater than any of the software costs that are associated with it. And I think that that's probably the biggest thing to keep in mind when you're evaluating these things, and what you're comfortable with using isn't so much the getting started cost, it's the down the road cost. And that down the road cost, you shouldn't be looking at your software for that, because you're going to start comparing, you know, Ruby to a Windows license, and oh well, Ruby runs on a Linux stack and, you know, .NET runs on Windows. Windows is going to be more expensive. Yeah, probably a little bit, but at the same time, the incremental cost between a Linux server and a Windows server is not that much versus the cost between having no employees and 1 employee, and that is a huge, huge step. So I would look at those for the costs versus what the cost of the software is.
Yeah, that's a good analysis of it. I think that most people do look at the free cost of open source and think to themselves, you know, why would I go with a more expensive platform like .NET? And I think you've listed a few good reasons. These days, if I'm looking at building a new project, I do tend to lean towards open source. There are just some really good communities out there that we've talked about before, the Ruby community, PHP community. I think Python with Django is actually a really good stack to build on. Some of the drawbacks I've heard folks building stuff on Python, and then you can't find developers for it, or they're really expensive. And actually, Ruby devs, really good startup Ruby devs, are expensive. And they're going to be potentially more expensive than .NET developers who tend to get paid well. But I think just Ruby devs are in more demand in the startup circles right now. In terms of finding employees, since you covered a lot of the other elements, I was thinking about finding developers, finding contractors. And in my experience, finding PHP developers has been easier than finding a good .NET or a good Ruby or Python developer. And so that's something to think about. PHP developers are going to tend to be less expensive as well. On the flip side, you know, in terms of finding a .NET developer, they're going to think more like maybe an enterprise consultant. Most people who develop .NET are not working for small startups, because most small startups don't use Microsoft technologies. And so you're going to be much more likely to find a kind of a PHP or Ruby hacker who has potentially, you know, built and launched stuff before. Whereas in the .NET world, it's much less likely that, that people have worked on small startups. So you're going to have a bit of a different mentality there in general. These are all generalities and these are all based on our experience. But I think these days when I look at a new project like I'm working on now, I lean towards open source. And as long as I can find people at a reasonable price and the technology is proven and I'm not doing anything that's crazy, you know, that specifically requires hitting some Windows system APIs or that requires a lot of scheduled tasks or any specific technology that, you know, that Microsoft.NET stuff would be more well designed to handle, then I do lean towards PHP and Ruby for web technologies.
One of the things that comes to mind in terms of the difficulty of finding .NET developers versus PHP developers is that PHP is really meant for web-based products versus .NET, which kind of covers both desktop and mobile and web. And you kind of have to pick and choose a little bit more because those people who are doing .NET, they may have done mobile, but they haven't done web stuff or vice versa. Or they've done desktop stuff, but not web stuff. And they can fall into a number of traps of saying, you know, they're just trying to get a job and they're saying, yeah, I can do that. I do .NET all the time. And you run into some of these issues about hiring them because they know .NET, but they don't necessarily know it in the context that you need them to know it.
Right. So there's added complexity in that it's a multi-use technology. Well, thanks for your question, Jack. Our next question is actually a lightning round of questions about starting up. And so it's from Derek, and he says, I'm so glad I found your podcast. I'm going to go back and try to listen to most of them. I have so many business and technology questions on how to get my web app out of the gate. I like how you guys talk details. Many podcasts I listen to are good, but I get frustrated by the lack of detail. For example, here are some huge things to me that may be little to an existing startup. And he sent over a kind of a long bulleted list. I think we're going to pick out a handful of these and just give some quick answers on our recommendations for doing these things. So first thing he said is, how do I find the right business name?
I think that the right business name is almost immaterial. The business that you have behind your company is, it doesn't matter to most people. I mean, you don't want it to be offensive. You don't want it to conflict with other people who have trademarks on other names out there. But I don't think that getting the right business name makes a whole heck of a lot of difference. There are certain things that you want to try and follow as generalities. So for example, you don't want to have too many consonants in a business name that's going to make it hard to pronounce. You don't want something that has a word in it that matches multiple ways to say it in whatever language that you're speaking, for example. You want to have the domain name, the .com available if possible. But again, most of these things are immaterial. The business name itself means almost nothing to your customers. It means something to you. So I think at the end of the day, the business name doesn't mean a heck of a lot. Now, your product name could mean quite a bit to you based on whether you're trying to do things with SEO or you're trying to make it memorable to people. That's a little bit different, but I think that the business name itself just does not matter as much.
I wholeheartedly agree. And the people who I've talked to lately who are selling multiple software products, you don't even know what their business name is. It's very rare that that matters to anyone. In terms of finding a good product name, I tend to just do domain searches. I spent 2 or 3 hours just packing together different parts of words when I was trying to figure out the name for what is now Drip. And then I looked for all the domain, you know, all the .coms for those, and almost none of them were available. I mean, it's crazy how hard it is to find a good domain. And so I based mine almost solely on being able to find a decent domain and find one that suits your fancy.
One that I've, a website I've mentioned a couple of times on this podcast before is leandomainsearch.com, which is a good website to go to if you're trying to find a website name, because it will search through, you give it a couple of keywords and it will search and give you a number of different variations on those keywords for what is available.
Yep, and nameboy.com is another one that I've used. All right, so his next question is, when should I become official and when should one incorporate or become an LLC or something else?
When to become official as a business and when to incorporate or become an LLC, those depend on your risk tolerance. If you've got nothing to protect, then it doesn't really make a whole heck of a lot of sense to incorporate and go through all the processes associated with getting an S-Corp or an LLC. In terms of your taxes, your CPA may feel completely differently about it, but once you have kind of gone past the state of doing your taxes yourself. As soon as you get a business involved, you probably want to get a CPA involved because they're going to know things that you don't. They'll be able to guide you into what decisions to make for your business, what things can be written off, what things can't, and then an attorney will teach you about how to structure businesses such that they will protect you from being liable to your customers or from other entities who are out there. But if you don't have anything to protect, if you're still just working on it, it's probably not a big deal. I don't even know as I would bother incorporating or filing a DBA or anything like that unless you just want to start writing things off or you have something that you want to protect. So if you already have a product or you're acquiring a product, that's probably a good time to start looking at it.
Until you have someone willing to pay you money for something, it's immaterial what form your business takes. Agree that it's a matter of risk tolerance. I also think that you can easily kill thousands of dollars and a lot of time and basically postpone the inevitable of actually asking people for their money. You can postpone the inevitable by worrying about this kind of thing. It's not nearly as important as most people think. His next question is, how and where should I open a merchant account for accepting e-commerce transactions? I got to be honest, these days, I just send people to Stripe. I say, unless you have a reason not to, go to stripe.com. It takes you 5 minutes to sign up. There you have the whole shebang.
Yeah, my question would be, why even bother opening up a merchant account? It just doesn't seem to make sense to me to even try for a merchant account these days. I mean, it's a lot of paperwork. It's a lot of hassle. And the amount of extra money that you're going to get using a merchant account versus, you know, using Stripe or something like that, it's just not worth it. And in fact, many times until your volume gets above a certain point, having a merchant account does zero for you.
He has a few others. I think the one other we'll pull out of here. He says, I plan on releasing an MVP. I know my target market, but how do I solicit them? How do I get them to know I exist?
I think finding people in your target market and soliciting them and getting them to know that you exist is a massive topic that we've probably covered quite a few times in previous podcasts. And I know that you said you're kind of new to this podcast. There's a lot more information in the previous 112 episodes. So definitely go back and listen to those. If you have follow-up questions, definitely let us know. But there's a lot of other information there.
Our next question is from Justin Shimura, who has sent in several questions before. His question is, I'm looking to venture into the startup world. A recurring theme that I've gotten from your episodes is knowledge is power, especially when building a startup. Being a developer, I obviously lack necessary business skills to maybe start with something big. My question is, do you have any suggestions on starting out with a business that's low risk and low profit, just so I can maybe learn and hone skills needed to do something more involved? It doesn't need to make money either. I was just thinking something like a simple t-shirt or hat business, which seems to have a low initial investment, but maybe a good arena to practice marketing, managing, etc. Thanks, guys, and keep up the good work.
I think my take on this is that acting as an affiliate for any sort of t-shirt or hat business would probably be a good way to get started. If you have ideas about what sorts of things can go on to those types of things, you could set up like a cafe press account, or there's several other companies that have popped up over the years. They're the ones that I remember using a while back. But you can essentially create your own store and you'll get a commission on all of those things and you can drive people to your own website. Another one that I can think of is building something along the lines of an info product. So any sort of informational or tutorial-based product where you are conveying information to people that they are going to find valuable, whether it's based on a hobby that you have or on something that you're just interested in learning more about and you want to be able to take that information and relay it to other people. If you're finding it difficult to find information about a particular topic, it's probably a good candidate for some sort of an ebook. And you don't have to put a huge amount of time and effort into it, but you can set up a landing page, try and get people to that website, see if people are searching for it, do some basic SEO on it, try and evaluate the need for people to purchase that kind of thing. And if there is, then you can go out and actually build the info product. You don't have to worry about whether or not you can build it or not. The real questions behind it are people interested in buying that?
Yeah, I think starting a t-shirt or hat business is probably not a good idea. I don't know what that's going to teach you that you're going to then take away and apply to a software startup, especially if you're trying to buy equipment and print the t-shirts yourself. I have a friend who runs a t-shirt deal a day site, and it's an enormous amount of time just to fulfill orders, and that doesn't teach you anything. I think you're going to be much better off with some type of digital product, and like Mike said, whether that's an online course of some kind, an ebook, or building some type of small app that you can build in a couple of weeks, or being an affiliate for someone else's software product. And that's something that's often overlooked. People feel like being an affiliate is not going to actually teach them anything, or like it's not being a real entrepreneur. But learning how to find a channel of traffic and how to get yourself in the way of that, whether that is via SEO or whether it's some paid acquisition or whether it's using social networks, I mean, there's a number of ways beyond that to do it. And learning how to navigate those and actually having something to make a little bit of money, it will teach you a lot about everything. I mean, about the email marketing and dealing with customer support and how to drive traffic and how to optimize and how to monetize and all that stuff. The entrepreneurs that I see who are starting out and they are doing smaller products that are not code heavy, because you already know how to code, right? So learning to code is not the scary part. It's all the other stuff. So if you can build either a very small project and do like a show Hacker News and try to get people to actually sign up for a trial, but then figure out a way to get some kind of money out of that, I think you're way better off than just trying to either give something away for free, which is really easy to do, or sitting down for 6 months and writing a full software product. So I hope that helps. Our next question is a voicemail question on outsourcing marketing.
Hey, Mike and Rob. I wanted to call in and say that I really enjoy your podcast, and I had a question for you. You talk a lot on the show about outsourcing various tasks. One of the things that I thought would be really nice to outsource would be marketing, but it seems like such a core activity that I question whether it's a good idea to outsource it. On the other hand, I read another book recently, Masters of Doom, and it talks about how much further beyond his peers, John Carmack's able to progress as a programmer and developing engines for Doom and Quake and so on by just focusing on programming and not worrying about marketing or some of the business concerns that they push off to their distributors. So I'm just curious what your thoughts on that are, and I look forward to hearing your next podcast.
So I think my first thought on that is that John Carmack is an extreme outlier.
Yep. And so is the video game industry. It's totally different than the software businesses we're talking about.
Right. That's my first thing that I just want to throw out there right away. The second thing is that I don't believe that you can outsource your entire marketing effort. I think that there are certain things that you can outsource associated with your marketing effort, but I think that the core ideas behind it, the high level vision, setting up the processes to do it, I think that that's something that you probably shouldn't outsource, because you're not going to know what to expect. So if you're a developer, outsourcing your marketing is probably a really bad idea, because you don't know what it takes. So when somebody comes back and says, oh, it's going to take me 3 weeks to put together this email campaign, you have zero basis for comparison to say, no, it doesn't take 3 weeks. It shouldn't take 3 weeks. It should take you 30 minutes or 3 hours or something like that. But if you don't have any sort of basis for comparison, then you just kind of have to shrug your shoulders and say, okay. Versus if you sit down and put together the processes that somebody else needs to follow, and for example, sending out emails, if you need to do something within MailChimp or AWeber or whatever email service provider you're using to send out emails on a regular basis, to get some of those things set up, not necessarily to write all the content for them, but to get those things set up, and maybe you want to send out a specific email for an end of the year promotion that you're trying to do. Something like that, you should have a good idea of how it should be done. And if those types of promotions are things that you're going to be doing on a fairly regular basis, then you're going to want to document those things, and you're probably going to want to be able to outsource them. Because if it's going to take you 3 hours to do it, and you know what the process is going to be to have that done, you can outsource that. But you have to have put in the time and effort up front to be able to set those processes in place to have somebody else do them. But once you've got them in place, that's something that you can definitely automate. You could definitely outsource that. But building that is not something I would advise. And when it comes to all of the strategic things behind your marketing efforts, you want to be able to track from initial customer contact all the way through to the complete life cycle of your customer, how many times you have to touch that customer in terms of your support costs, how many times they have to be contacted with your emails, and you want to have all of that statistical information. And if you're trying to outsource that to somebody else, I question how well that's going to work out, because they're not going to be nearly as invested in the business as you are, and they're probably not going to be thinking of the high-level strategic things that you are, because there's certain things that as a business owner you're going to need to know and you want to know versus somebody who you've just hired to do that. And they may know their stuff, they may know how to do that stuff very well, but you're probably better off hiring them on a consulting basis to help advise you about the different things that you can do, and then you go off and do those things.
I'd like to start by maybe defining terms, because you can outsource tasks and you can outsource projects, and it's very, very different. If you find someone on Odesk for $10 or $15 an hour and you write up a process, you can outsource the task to them. And that's one thing, right? So you can either have them be doing support or just a basic step-by-step process. You can even create some content for an infographic and you can outsource the specific task of designing that to someone for a few hundred dollars. But to go to someone and say, here's a project, I want you to do all the content marketing. And that's likely going to include infographics and blogs and articles and all that kind of stuff. That requires an entirely different level of competency on that person, and they need initiative. They're going to be astronomically more expensive. It can literally be the difference between paying someone $15 an hour and paying someone $3,000 a month to handle all of your content marketing. Those are actual numbers that I've received and, you know, gotten quotes for them. But the difference is that if you have enough money and you don't have enough time, then you go with that project-based thing. I threw out $3,000. That was a cheap quote, by the way. There were many people who quoted 10 grand a month, basically handle the whole, you know, content marketing aspect of a startup business. So you really need to think about the difference between those. I don't think that outsourcing it to an agency, that's what I'm saying, is like the project type, that's actually can work for you. And I know startups who've done it, and I know that it works, but those agencies are extremely expensive. And I don't think that's what you're talking about. Most bootstrapped, self-funded companies are not doing it that way. And you can only afford to outsource tasks. Second thought is that marketing is absolutely core activity. That's something I've talked about a lot, and it's very hard. In fact, I've never outsourced my project-based marketing to anyone until I found that product manager who's now, you know, working with me on Hittail. It took a while for me to have confidence in him to do that kind of stuff, but other than that, I only outsource task-based elements of it. If you have an infinite amount of money, then yes, you would hire experts in-house. You'd hire employees, or you'd hire some kind of long-term contract, and they would do both your development and marketing, right? You'd hire employees to do it, and that's what big venture-funded businesses do, and that's the ideal situation. But when you have $500 a month of revenue, or $500 a month from your salary gig, and you're trying to fund this, you just can't do that, and you have to make a decision, which of these things am I going to outsource? And in that case, I really do think that the development side is easier to spec out. It's easier to find someone who can give a product good enough that people can use until you can build this business up. And if you do, in fact, have product market fit and can market this thing. And I also think that the marketing side is the one that takes the vision and the expertise. And if you, the founder and entrepreneur, don't have that going into a bootstrap startup, I genuinely do not see a way that you can be successful. I think that has to be your number one core competency. Even if you love development, even if you're going to do all the development yourself, you have to love the marketing too. Because if you don't, then the business goes nowhere, because no one else is going to drive that engine. And that's the engine that's going to basically drive your whole business. So thanks, John, for that question.
If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups, or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.